I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to Constant Wonder. There is a particular usage of the verb to strike that means you are lowering or letting something down. You can strike a flag, for instance. You do that when you surrender your ship to an enemy. It's a signal you give that you're done fighting, you've had enough, you quit. Or maybe the enemy isn't another ship. Maybe it's a gale force wind, a hurricane. And in that case, you strike the sails, meaning you lower those and you secure them so they don't get shredded. You don't want them to be useless when you need them. Striking a tent, that's possible. That means taking the tent down. Striking a movie or theater set means you dismantle the stage set. And it may possibly have its origins in those nautical routes. One of the strangest Hollywood thingies that ever took place was when it was time to strike the set for a silent movie back in 1923. The production management and crew for the first iteration of the Ten Commandments, which is not to say the first of the ten, but the first version of all ten. And I'm not talking about the Charlton Heston version here. I'm going back before that. The production crew management were not content just to pull things down. They decided they would strike their set by burying the whole thing. And it was a vast mock-up of an ancient Egyptian architectural complex, and they buried it in a sand dune. I said that this was immense, and possibly the reason for that was to meet the ambitions of the legendary filmmaker Cecil B. DeMille. And even though this set was on the California coast, there was no doubt something quite poetic about concealing it under sand, because Egypt has sand too, as we all know, and a lot of stuff has gone missing there under the blowing winds near the Nile. Well, why did they do this in California, these movie makers? Why bury the set? And how could the fact of its burial be almost erased, almost completely forgotten from history? And who decided it should be located and documented and if possible, retrieved, if not in whole, in part? Well, that would be our next guest. It's a pleasure to have with us Peter Brosnan. He is a screenwriter, a director who for over 30 years pursued the lost city of Cecil B. DeMille. And then in 2016, he came out with a documentary by that title, The Lost City of Cecil B. DeMille. Brosnan is with us now on the line. Peter Brosnan, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you, Marcus. A pleasure to be here with you.
You have told this story so many times, and just come clean and tell me, is it a story that you have tired of telling? Because, man, I watched the documentary, and it just seems that you were put through so much, and here I'm doing it to you all over again.
It's, you know, the one thing that has kept me with this project for so many decades is that despite all the ups and downs, it has always been a fun project. Getting to interview so many of the people who worked with DeMille back in the 1920s and the 1950s, that was just exciting. Getting to work on the archaeological part of it and run up and down the Guadalupe Dunes, acting out all my Indiana Jones fantasies, that has been fun too. Going to so many different places to show the film and talk about the project, that's been fun. And now getting to talk to BYU, it continues to be a fun project. So I think I'm going to stay with it for a while.
Well, so you have not struck the set on this project of yours. I mean, the documentary has made, it's 4 or 5 years ago. Is this a work in progress?
Well, the documentary is no longer a work in progress, thank goodness. I was finally able to finish that. For almost 30 years, I had a couple of boxes way in the back of my garage with all these wonderful film and videotape interviews that I had done, and they were way in the back of the garage. I mean, behind the Halloween decorations. but now the film is finally finished, and that's wonderful. But because we finally got the archaeology begun on the site in 2012, we finally proved that there is a lot of material buried there. You know, in 1923, Cecil B. DeMille buried enough artifacts in the Guadalupe Dunes to fill several museums. These are a direct link to the very earliest days of an American industry that went on to become one of the most powerful cultural forces of the 20th century. They are saved nowhere else. You know, if you go to the Smithsonian in Washington, you'll see Ben Franklin's printing press. You'll see the Wright Brothers airplane. But artifacts from the earliest days of the American film industry, there's nothing. Well, in the Guadalupe Dunes, there's a lot. We uncovered a bit in 2012. The archaeologists went back in 2015 and 2017. They uncovered an entire Sphinx body, an entire Sphinx head. And I think work is going to continue there for many decades, if not many centuries to come, because there is so much buried there. And it's a direct link to the very earliest days of this important American industry, Hollywood.
Well, you know, I've seen the documentary and I have a lingering question. And I think you can, well, maybe not. We'll see if you can answer this. How did they bury it? It was huge. How do you bury a huge movie set in sand dunes?
Well, we had to do a little bit of, no pun intended, we had to do a little bit of digging to figure that out. The main part of the set was a huge wall. It was about 110 feet high and about 200 or 300 feet wide. We believe they used dynamite to blast the bottom part of that set. They pushed it over backwards. And then they pulled out all the wood that was under it, and the wood was donated to people in the town. In the town in Guadalupe, there are now houses built from wood from the set. And then they pushed sand over that part of the set. And once we realized that, it was very helpful because we could look at a photograph of that set, imagine it being pushed over backward, and that would really tell us where we would find some of the bas-relief statues that were on the wall of the set. But the big question was, how do they bury two dozen sphinxes, each of which weighed about 5 tons. Well, it turns out there was a guy named Alan Chapman who had an early version of a bulldozer. He dug apparently 2 long, deep trenches, pushed all those sphinxes into the trenches, and then covered them over with sand. And it turns out sand is an excellent preservative for plaster. So as long as these materials have been buried in the sand, they're still very well preserved. That's why we believe there's so much material here that museums we'll be able to share for many years to come.
Now, is this just sweeping something under the rug? I mean, what was the motive for burying it?
Well, there's been some discussion about that, and we think there were two motives. Number one, when DeMille finished his film, he was way over schedule and or way over budget, way behind schedule. His bosses at Paramount were already screaming bloody murder. So he had to get rid of the set cheaply. He had an agreement with the property owners that said he was going to have to remove everything from the site. We think it was just quicker and cheaper to bury it. And after that, it looked like he removed everything. The more interesting motive is that if he had left the site, if he had let the set rather standing, by the time he got back to Hollywood, other filmmakers would have rushed in, made a cheap version of a movie on the set, and been out with it on the streets before he could even process his film. This was the early days of Hollywood. It was kind of like the Wild West days. There were rival film companies in competition with each other, not afraid to steal somebody else's set. So in a sense, DeMille was protecting his patent on this set by destroying it before somebody else could use it.
Yeah. So what was it that happened? I know this is years and years ago, but what happened that something switched inside your mind and heart and you said, I'm going after this story? You had to be convinced to begin with that the story was even true, that there was a movie set under the sand.
Well, this was back in 1982. I was living with an old friend of mine, Bruce Cardozo. We had gone to the New York University Film School together. I had moved in with him. Bruce had always been a huge fan of Cecil B. DeMille. And one night, for no apparent reason, Bruce told me this crazy story about Cecil B. DeMille burying sphinxes in the middle of California. I thought Bruce was nuts. But then he showed me DeMille's autobiography, in which DeMille joked about archaeologists in 1,000 years finding buried sphinxes and thinking they had found some hitherto unknown Egyptian civilization on the Pacific coast. We were young wannabe filmmakers, and we thought this could make a dynamite documentary. But how do we find this place called Guadalupe? Well, it turns out Guadalupe is a tiny town about 3 hours from Hollywood. And after a few phone calls, I found a restaurant owner and rancher in Guadalupe, a guy named Clarence Minetti. And he was one of the co-owners of the Guadalupe Dunes. And he was familiar. He knew the Ten Commandments had been filmed out there. Everybody in town did. It was part of the town's history. Almost everybody had parents or grandparents who had worked on the film. But Clarence knew nothing about the set being buried. But he introduced me to a friend of his, an old cowboy named Joe Gray. And one morning in June of 1983, Joe led us out to the site. Now, this was right after the first winter of El Nino storms in California, one big storm after another had come in off the Pacific. And those storms had blown 3 or 4 feet of sand off the Guadalupe Dunes. So when Bruce and I and our friend Richard Eberhardt visited the dunes one morning, lo and behold, here were acres of statues sticking up out of the sand. We very quickly identified one of the statues, a 6-foot-wide horse's head, as one of the statues that had been on the wall of the Ten Commandments set. And we realized DeMille didn't just bury sphinxes. It looked like he had buried the entire set. We thought this is just going to make a fantastic documentary film. We'll hire some archaeologists to dig it up. We'll film interviews with old-timers who worked on the film. The story writes itself. We'll be done with our film in a year or two. It was a great idea, but it didn't quite work out like that. There were a few delays ahead.
Yeah, 30 years later.
30 years later, yeah.
So right from the get-go, when you first went out there to see the dunes for the first time, are you already shooting stuff?
Yeah, we were filmmakers. We brought 16-millimeter cameras with us, and we uncovered the filming of that horse's head. And over the next 5 or 6 years, Bruce and Richard and I and a couple of other people, we continued filming. Even though there was no archaeology happening, we realized that people who had worked on the film were now in their 70s, 80s, 90s. And if we were going to get their stories on film, we had to do it now. So we had no funding. And, you know, 16-millimeter film was very expensive. But on our own time and our own dime, we filmed as many interviews as we could with people who were chariot drivers, people who were extras, people who worked on building the set, friends and relatives of DeMille. And I'm so glad that we did that in the 1980s because those people are long gone, and yet we now have their stories on film.
Yeah. In the documentary, there's Agnes DeMille, and I think that's a niece, right?
Yes.
Is that footage something that you shot, or is that archival stuff from earlier?
I shot that footage. Actually, Bruce and Richard and I shot that footage in New York City early in 1985 at her home in New York City. And the original 16-millimeter footage is now at the BYU archives. But Agnes DeMille was a fascinating interview. She was already in her 80s when we interviewed her. She was a famous American choreographer. She did Rodeo, Oklahoma. By the time we interviewed her, she had just had a massive stroke a few years earlier. And they told her she would never walk again. She would probably never be able to use her hands again. But because of all her training as a dancer, she went through all the rehab exercises. And by the time we met her, she was using a walker, but she was actually moving around. It was just amazing. When we were interviewing her, at one point, we were waiting for the cameraman to switch film reels. And for whatever reason, we could not turn the lights off. And the lights were very bright. And when I watched this old woman begin to wither under the lights. She had at one point been very strong and very forceful. And then under the lights, she just began to wither. And I thought to myself, oh my God, I'm going to kill Agnes DeMille. But when the camera was ready, the cameraman said, okay, action. Suddenly she was on. She summoned up this energy from within her. She was like a bull. And she just went right into that interview. And that gave me a little bit of insight into what her uncle must have been like, into that DeMille energy that just built the American film industry and powered him through 50 years of filmmaking.
Well, in your documentary, there are so many people that you have interviewed, and you put this together in the grand montage of stories about the making of the movie and about this grand personality, Cecil B. DeMille. There's no way that we're going to rehearse all of that here. So I'm wondering if we can just take Agnes as kind of prototypical of the type of people who were in his sphere of his relationships and the kind of the presence that he was in their lives. He just seems so much larger than life, and people knew it then and they remembered it. And of course she's related to him, so she might have something more to say in the way of keeping up the family reputation. But just about everybody you met had good stuff to say for the most part.
For the most part, yeah. There were people who I met who actually had a hard time talking about DeMille in the past tense. He was still such a presence in their life. And for about 40 years after he died, his house in Hollywood was preserved exactly as it had been when he was alive, to the ex- sent that his secretary would come to his desk every morning and change the date on his desk calendar.
Oh, my.
He was just a dominating, incredibly inspiring presence in the lives of almost everybody who met him. Even the people who he yelled at and screamed at on the set, they all respected him, and they all found that they grew from knowing him.
Well, I'm not interested necessarily in the warts and all kind of history. I'm interested in this iconic figure, because whether or not that figure, the icon, is true or not, the icon was, and America knew it, and America admired that and believed in that. A few people rise to that stature in life.
Absolutely. He was, whether you liked him or not, and there were many people who did not like him, especially during the anti-communist days of the 50s and the 60s, he took a very principled stand, and he paid dearly for it. But almost everybody admired, well, first of all, what he did for the American film industry. Many years back, I got to interview a guy named Hal Roach, who was another icon of early Hollywood. Hal was the guy who put Laurel and Hardy together. He made all their movies. He made all the Little Rascal movies. He was a giant of Hollywood in those days, and he knew DeMille very well. He lived to be 100 years old, and I interviewed him in the 1980s. And I asked him about DeMille, and he stopped for a minute, and he shook his head, and he said, "Oh, DeMille. Before DeMille, movies were these tiny things you would go and you would look at in a Nickelodeon. You'd put your coin in, you'd peer through a little slot. That's what movies were. When DeMille came along, he blew out the walls. He showed that movies could fill a huge screen with huge images. They could take us to another time and place and make us believe that it was real. He invented how to tell stories with moving images." And he really deserves to be recognized for his place in American cinema, because he really was the first.
Yeah, that's not an overstatement, you don't think?
I don't think so, no. There were other people who were making movies before him, but when DeMille came along, Hollywood and movies became synonymous with each other. And, you know, I'm told that anywhere you go in the world, there are two words in the English language that people recognize. One of them is okay. The other is Hollywood.
Yeah.
And without Cecil B. DeMille, there would be no Hollywood. For over 100 years, the Hollywood film industry that DeMille created brought a positive image of America and American culture to the entire world. Anywhere you go in the world today, even if it's a country we've bombed or invaded, they may hate us, but they love Hollywood movies. Hollywood movies, and DeMille was at the forefront, have been our best ambassador for a century.
I want to chat with you in just a moment about the two Ten Commandment movies. That gives us a full contingent of 20 commandments, I suppose. But I'd like you to compare the two of them and tell us about your favorite. After a short break here on our show, we're visiting with Peter Brosnan. He's the documentarian behind The Lost City of Cecil B. DeMille, a film from 2016. Stay with us. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. It's a great pleasure to have Peter Brosnan with us, and he spent over 30 years pursuing the story of, not just the story of, the artifacts behind that lost city of Cecil B. DeMille. He made a documentary about it all. We're talking about the stage set for the 1923, the first movie, The Ten Commandments. There were two of them. And I guess I should have known that, Peter. How can it be that I thought that it was just, you know, the second one was everything? I mean, what was wrong with me?
Well, the second one is what is still 50 years later, 60 years later, being shown on ABC television every year at Easter and Passover. It's become an American icon. Everybody knows that film. But as time has passed on, people have forgotten a little bit about Cecil B. DeMille and about what went on before that. I think film aficionados know about his earlier career, but most people have forgotten about it. And he was such an icon in the early days of Hollywood, such an icon in building what we now think of as Hollywood, that we really need to pay more attention to his earlier work.
So let's at least give me the scope of this earlier work. How many minutes is that first silent film from 23?
Well, the first silent film is actually a bit over 2 hours long. But it's only the first 30 or 40 minutes that actually are the story of Moses and the Pharaoh and the Exodus. It was fairly common in those days to make films in kind of a two-part fashion. You would have one part that was an ancient historical prologue, and then the second part of the film would be kind of a modern morality tale. And that's what he did with the first version of the Ten Commandments in 1923. The first half of the movie is the story of Moses, Pharaoh, and the Exodus. And then the second part of the film is a morality play that takes place in San Francisco, in which there is a mother who has a huge Bible, and one of her sons keeps all the Ten Commandments, the other son breaks all the Ten Commandments. and actually, it's actually a very touching film. I watched it again just a couple of years ago, and once you can get past the silent film acting, it's actually a very touching film. And a fascinating thing about it, part of the film was filmed at the Church of St. Peter and Paul in San Francisco, which was under construction at that time. And they actually got to film up on the top of the church. And it's a wonderful document of San Francisco in 1923.
Yeah. So you like it a lot. And when you say you like the earlier version a lot, you're talking primarily about the ancient story.
Of course, the ancient story was and still is. Well, no other word fits. It was a spectacle. It was a spectacular. Thousands of extras, a huge set, thousands and thousands of animals. It still fills the screen and captures your attention. And parts of it were filmed in early Technicolor, and those sequences are also just exquisite. So it's still fascinating and wonderful to watch, and it set the tone for future epics.
In a way, the American obsession with all things epic kind of begins with this man. I just can't even imagine that America would have been, of course, you know, after the Industrial Revolution, there are all these big public works projects, and eventually we have things like the Golden Gate Bridge. That's pretty big. And we get our Mount Rushmore. That's pretty big. But from Hollywood, for them to be kind of setting the pace for America, I think our obsession with the epic might go back to this movie.
It does. And that's a time in which America was showing the world how to do big things. That was the beginning of our golden age. And movies were certainly part of that. And you mentioned the Golden Gate Bridge. The Golden Gate Bridge was partially funded by Bank of America, whose president was a guy named A.P. Giannini. And Giannini and DeMille were very good friends. When DeMille went over budget making the Ten Commandments, Paramount cut the cord. They said, we're not going to fund anymore. DeMille went to his friend A.P. Giannini. Giannini put together some investors. They offered to buy the film from Paramount. Paramount backed down. So, yes, it was that era in America. And these people were rubbing shoulders with each other and helping each other.
So what is it about that earlier film that you think excels the second version from 1956, is it?
Yeah. 1956. Well, obviously, the second version was done, you know, with all the power and glory that a 1950s movie studio could summon. Incredible special effects, sound, full Technicolor, and it's glorious to watch. I just saw it on Easter in a theater with my kids. What I like about the earlier version of the film, especially the Exodus sequence, when I watch the Exodus, I feel like I'm watching home movies from the actual Exodus. It has that sense of realism. One of the cameramen of the film was a fellow named Edward S. Curtis. He was famous for his film and photo studies of Native Americans, Alaskan Eskimos. And every once in a while, he would come back to Hollywood and work on a film to make some more money so he could go back to documenting Native Americans. He was one of the cameramen on the Exodus sequence. And I think his influence shows there's a sense of realism in that Exodus sequence that's just glorious. I really feel like I'm watching newsreels or home movies of the actual event.
Yeah, that's really something. Because I guess the second version is a little bit prettified in a way, isn't it?
It is prettified. A lot of it was shot in a studio. And the fellow who designed the set for the second version of the film, Walter Tyler, who I interviewed back in the 1980s, he told me that when DeMille told him to design a set for the new version of the film, first he looked at the 1920s version of the film. And then DeMille said, I want you to rebuild this, but I want you to make it better. And if you can't make it better, then we'll just re-release the old version of the film. So Tyler basically took the design for the early version of the set, and I guess prettified it would be a good word, but we also knew a lot more about ancient Egypt by then. So they were able to make it more true to what the original Egyptian architecture would have been, and they were able to use more modern construction methods. So it did look better, and they had Technicolor, VistaVision. So, of course, it was a much more beautiful film.
I want to ask you something this is kind of an odd question, but and this isn't about Cecil B. DeMille per se. It's not even about the movie per se. It just has to do with finding things in the earth that are buried. And there's kind of a treasure hunt aspect to it. And I'm wondering if, you studied film. Yeah, you're into this deeper than most people are. This has been your livelihood. But I'm just wondering if there's something just kind of, I don't know how to, in the bones of us humans that we want to find something that's hidden. And if that's kind of been what helped to drive you along too.
Yeah, I think as long as there have been people walking on this planet, we've been digging in the ground and saying, hey, what do you think this is? Let's dig it up. In the last couple of hundred years, we've kind of codified that into the science of archaeology. And that's wonderful because the science of archaeology is really about finding stuff that's left over from the past. And yesterday's garbage helps us to understand who we were then and how we got to where we are now. So it really is a process of learning about ourselves. And when you begin to study that, you begin to become very happy that people did bury stuff or throw stuff out of their pockets 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago.
Well, I guess behind my question is, did you miss your calling in life? You could have certified to be a bona fide archaeologist had you wanted to.
I've had so many careers. Actually, archaeology might be a good second chapter or third chapter for me now. Yeah. But, in a way, filmmaking and archaeology really overlap in a very nice way. We're both storytellers. Filmmakers use words and pictures. Archaeologists use artifacts that they recover from the ground. And when you put the two together, there's a real synergy that happens. And when you're using film to tell a story about archaeologists recovering stuff from the ground, and you actually have, in our case, the actual 1923 film to show what the stuff looked like before it became an artifact, that's just a setup for a wonderful filmmaking opportunity.
In a weird kind of a way, it seems like movies are more ephemeral. And I know that Library of Congress and other people have been going through these big projects to digitize and to preserve and to find how to keep the stuff from deteriorating. The preservationists are all over this, and they want to keep the movies intact. And a lot of stuff lost that are contemporary movies from when DeMille was making his first Ten Commandments. I'm just wondering if when you go out to the sand and you say the plaster is so well preserved deep in sand, it's almost more secure than movies themselves.
That's true, and that's very sad. By some estimates, 95% of all the silent movies made in this country are lost. They're gone. Imagine if we had lost 95% of Hemingway. That would be recognized as a huge cultural loss. Well, losing all those movies is a huge cultural loss. They're gone. And as far as artifacts from those early days, there's nothing. There's a little museum in Hollywood called Hollywood Heritage. And if you go there, you'll see some beautiful cameras and props and costumes. But aside from that, there's really nothing because we have saved nothing. The films themselves are gone. And there are almost no artifacts from that era. But in the Guadalupe Dunes, Cecil B. DeMille buried enough artifacts to fill several museums. So I certainly think and hope that archaeologists will be going to the dunes and saving what's there for many years to come, because it's not just the set, it's not just statues. DeMille had several thousand people living on that site, building the set, acting in the film. They were there for months. Things fell out of their pockets. They left things behind. There's many things there that tell us about life in 1923. Just to give you one example, we have found a lot of tins which held rolling tobacco for cigarettes. This was back in the days when it was still considered safe to smoke. We've also found a lot of little bottles of cough medicine. This was during Prohibition. People were not buying the cough medicine because they were coughing. They were buying the cough medicine because it had a healthy dose of alcohol and it was a way around prohibition. We're finding lots of little things like this that tell us about life on a movie set and indeed life in general in 1923. So it's a fascinating time capsule.
So let's leave this discussion, this conversation of ours, with one last thing I have to know from you. What's the burning question that still lingers in your mind that you would like to answer next about this entire story of the lost city of Cecil B. DeMille? Is there something you're still hoping to see with your own eyes that's down in those dunes?
There is so much there. I'm still hoping we will recover some more intact sphinxes and some more artifacts about day-to-day life on a movie set. And I think work on the site is going to continue for many years.
Yeah. Well, such a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you about it. And it was a wonderful documentary. I enjoyed it tremendously. Peter Brosnan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Marcus. I really appreciate it.
Peter Brosnan, screenwriter and director, and for over 30 years he was pursuing the lost city of Cecil B. DeMille. That's the name also of his documentary about it. Now, that's all just surreal, of course. No other word for it. Surreal. A sustained archaeological quest to find and recover imitation Egyptian relics buried in a California desert. Who'd have thunk? What could be more Hollywood, actually, or more American, for that matter? A passion for preserving the not-so-ancient past. That's also behind the motives of our next guest here on Constant Wonder. We're just about to talk to the creator of the Rescued Film Project, a man who is trying to recover pieces of American history that would otherwise never see the light of day, might be destroyed forever. He's going to prevent that. Stay tuned for the story coming up next. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Every once in a while, probably like you, I find an old file, an old digital file. Sometimes it's in an old format. I think I've actually discarded the very last 5 1/4 floppy disk that once belonged to me. I still have a few zip and jazz drives somewhere in a cabinet. Let's not even start talking about cassette tapes and VHS tapes. Back in those days, storing things remotely on something that everyone calls the cloud, if you had talked like that, you would have drawn some fairly strange stares. You know, a lot of stuff goes missing, and a lot of stuff is irretrievable. In terms of data, audio, image storage, if you don't update, if you don't upgrade, some things will be lost forever. Every once in a while, I do stumble on an old roll of undeveloped film, Fuji. I found old Fuji film. And then you try to get it developed only to discover that there's nothing on it because it was compromised and light has destroyed whatever might have been on it. Well, our next guest here on Constant Wonder has had far better luck than that. I want you to meet Levi Bettweiser. He is founder of the Rescued Film Project. A while back, he switched to film photography. It's kind of taking a step back in time for some of us. Processing his own film. Some of us have never done that. And then he began collecting old rolls of film that he found in cameras in the Boise, Idaho area. And he was amazed to discover that many of the cameras he found had intact images, unspoiled film. And he began collecting the film from the internet as well and from donations. And that is how the Rescued Film Project came about. We have a chance to visit with him right now. Levi Bettweiser, welcome to our show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How long have you been going at this now, rescuing film?
Oh, you know, I think I'm going around 6-7 years.
You just started finding old cameras and there was film in them?
Yeah, I'm an avid thrift store shopper, and I'm also a film photographer myself. And so, you know, the two worlds kind of collide when you're searching through the camera section at the thrift stores trying to find something cool. And yeah, I just started noticing that some of the cameras still had film in them. So since I was shooting film, processing film already, I figured I'd just start collecting them. And I got about, you know, 40 rolls, and then I decided I had enough to justify the time and money to do a batch processing. And I did it, and I honestly didn't think I'd get anything, but I was pretty shocked to see that the majority of the rolls, I got at least one image off of, and from there, I was just hooked. You know, I realized if I can get hundreds of images off 40 rolls of film just in my area, I mean, there's got to be thousands and thousands more rolls out there in the world that need to be rescued, and so I started hunting.
So is the rescue simply finding it, developing it, and then preserving the image? Is that what the rescue is?
Yeah, I think that's the physical side of it, right? So we're actually physically finding these rolls of film, processing them. Then we're storing the negatives safely, and then we're archiving the images digitally and sharing them with the world, right? So that's the rescue of the actual physical thing. I think the idea, though, is that the other side of it is it's more like rescuing memories or rescuing the existence of people, right? So these images are taken by people who want to remember these moments in time, and they never get to see them. But the fact that these moments matter enough for them to want to remember them, I think we need to honor that. And even if they're not going to be able to see them, we need to rescue those moments. And each one of these moments is not just a snapshot in that person's life. That's a glimpse into the history of humanity and to experiences and their little time capsules. You know, we rescue film from the 40s, 50s, but even the 90s, early 2000s. And so they may not feel as historic, the new ones, but I try and look at them as this in 30, 40 years, these are going to be moments of history that need to be documented.
So is that where the project ends, that you preserve these things, or there's got to be a part of you that wants to do the sleuthing, the detective work, and figure out who are these people?
Yeah. Right now the focus is just gathering film, processing it, and trying to get the images before the film degrades too long. I know that at some point I'm not going to be able to find any more film. Like, people aren't shooting film anymore, and when they do shoot it, they process it, right? Because it's not like it used to be where that was the only way that you could create images, because everyone uses digital. So yeah, the phase right now is the finding and the processing. And then I imagine, you know, years down the road, there's going to be the detective phase, right? Now, I myself am not a detective. Like, I don't have any experience in this kind of work, right? So I think my goal is to open up the archive for crowdsourcing and for the community and for other people to help with the investigation part. And just through the little bit that I do on social media and I put out there, it's already happening. People are already going out and finding the locations and trying to locate, you know, places which a lot of the photos were taken. And so it's already naturally happening.
Have you had enough serendipity in this where you've been able to identify a person on one of these images?
I have reconnected one roll of film with someone who is a subject of some of the photos. And it was years ago, right when the project started, through our Instagram, they saw that we posted a picture that ended up being her father. And she was in Portland, I believe, and this was a role that we'd rescued in Boise. So that was pretty serendipitous, but that has not happened since. But I have rescued roles of film where I knew the subjects of the images, like Dwight Eisenhower. There was an actor that was really popular in the 60s. I forget his name now. So there are subjects of the images that I've recognized that I know, but we've only reconnected one role so far.
So with the Eisenhower story, let me get this right. There's an old camera, perhaps, and you find a roll in it, or maybe somebody sends you this over the internet, I don't know. You get the film in your hands, you develop it, and you say, oh my, I think that's Eisenhower. Or did you know it was Eisenhower before you developed it?
You know, I didn't know right away. Like, you can tell in the negative, I was like, this is a pretty well photographed image. It's well lit. And it looks like someone important because they're, you know, standing like in front of a crowd. And then when I scanned it in, I had to do a double take. I'm like, this person looks really familiar. And eventually it just came to me about who it was. So yeah, it wasn't an immediate thing.
Well, that's a historic photograph. I mean, presidents get their picture taken all the time. But still, I mean, Eisenhower, that's a few years back.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing how even myself, before I started this, I never would have thought that film would have held up that long. Film is an organic substance, and it's very susceptible to changes in heat and light and moisture. And the fact that this roll of film, it was a medium format roll of film, had made it from, you know, that day, year, decades ago with Eisenhower, and now I have this really clean, clear image sitting in front of my computer, on my computer, is pretty incredible. Film is a pretty incredible thing.
What's your success rate? I can imagine that for every image that comes up crisp and clean, you're going to get maybe 50 really fuzzy ones and then maybe 500 that are just overexposed.
Yeah, I mean, there's multiple things, right? Like, if the image wasn't shot properly, then it's never going to be good, right? If it was overexposed or underexposed, there's that factor. Then there's the factor that yet a lot of times the role may not have even been shot, right? It may have just gotten wound up, so I get a lot of blanks because of that. But then it's just the role, like I said, the roles are organic. It's organic substances, and it doesn't stand through the years, particularly color film. And so I get a lot of just blank or irretrievable images because of that. So, you know, the archive has over 30,000 images at this point. I probably have around 2,000 rolls of film in my cold storage currently. And I got to say, I probably, for every roll, I would say a full roll of film that I get images on, I probably get maybe four that don't have images that I can get off of them. So it's about one in four, I would say.
Yeah. Now, 30,000, did you process all of those?
So there have been a couple like sub projects from Rescued Film where I have commissioned some other places to process for me, but I do all the scanning. But yeah, I've processed pretty much the majority of that myself. Done all the scanning. I do all the scanning myself. I haven't had anyone else scan. Yeah, and it's I'm in a little bit of a hiatus right now, to be honest. Life, family, career has kind of had to put a little backburn on the Rescued Film project, so I haven't processed in a while. But I have right now a couple hundred rolls that I need to scan, and actually scanning takes a lot longer than processing.
Of all of the images that I've heard about that you have gathered up and processed, and one of the more exciting one, we're talking about some photographs from World War II and lots of soldiers.
A couple years ago, I had acquired a bag of film from an online auction that seemingly was from a World War II soldier. The way that the rolls were labeled, they were like Normandy, Le Havre Harbor overseas, and like Fort Indiantown Gap in Pennsylvania. They were labeled with these things. And so it's not often I know what's going to be on a roll of film, but those ones, because they were labeled, I had obviously a good strong feeling that they were going to be historically important. And it was the first time I'd had something that seemed so important that it made me really nervous, right? I was extremely nervous that I was going to screw it up, because I could potentially, you know, ruin rolls of film that might have some extreme historical significance. But I documented the process in a video, and everything went pretty well. I did get some blank rolls out of it. It was 31 rolls. I think maybe a couple turned out blank. But when I saw these images, I was just floored. Like, my heart started pumping, and they aren't combat images. They are images of soldiers, you know, on base in the States, traveling on massive boats and having like church ceremonies on the deck of the ship, marching through the countryside overseas at a place called Lucky Strike Camp, which was a cigarette camp overseas. I've done a little research on, and they're just very, very iconic, and it humbled me to know that not only do I see these images, I'm holding these rolls of film that were in these places, right? They actually were there, and that's the thing I think we lose these days with digital is we carry our phone everywhere, we take pictures everywhere, but you don't have like a physical thing that you can tie to the locations and places you go like you can with film, because you know that thing from so long ago was there, and it has a different weight to it of importance. So yeah, it was pretty incredible, and that just continued my passion for the project to hopefully find more images like that.
How do you go fishing for these things? You say there was an auction?
I get them from all over. So I don't get as much from thrift stores anymore. It's not very time efficient, because I might spend a whole day and might maybe find one roll of film. So I used to do days where I'd go out and just travel around the valley and around and try and find them. So I don't do that as much anymore. But what I do is I search online all over the place. There are online auctions like eBay. But through all this, I've also established relationships with like camera resellers and dealers who kind of stock them up for me and send them to me. Oftentimes, I purchase them for small fees per roll. But we also accept donations of film. So we will process film for anyone for free as long as it's a roll of film that has been orphaned from its photographer, and we supply digital images back to the people if we are able to get them. So we get a good amount through donations as well. I've probably had over 500 donations of film, and a donation could be a roll, or it could be I've had donations of like 60, 70 rolls at a time.
I want to know if you've bumped into anybody else who's doing the same thing you're doing.
Yeah, you know, I think it's becoming more popular, to be honest, which is great. Like, I don't – like, if people are actively looking and rescuing rolls of film, that is the end goal, right? Let's rescue them all before they're gone. It doesn't have to be me. I think there are some other places – other people who do it kind of on the side as a passion project. I don't know if anyone does it to the scale that I do. And if they do, I don't know if it's as public. But what I've found is generally when people do it, they often include like negatives in what they do. So they find negatives and scan those, which has a different component to it. It's not the angle that we take with our project, where we truly only 100% of the images in our archive come from unprocessed rolls of film, which means they've never been seen by anyone, including the photographer. Negatives, as you know, they could have been printed at some point. They could be images hanging on people's walls and people's photo albums. And so our project truly is 100% unprocessed from unprocessed rolls of film.
I hesitate to ask this next question. Have you regretted developing anything? a murder scene or something?
Yeah, that's a pretty common question. And I've been lucky enough at this point to not, with maybe a few small exceptions, developed anything that is I wouldn't want to see. So out of 30,000 images, I can truly say that it's all pretty PG-13 and below rated.
Yeah, that kind of gives you a little faith in humanity, right?
Yeah. It's been, and that is one thing that is always looming in the back of my head, though, too. I've spoken about it with my wife. Am I worried I'm ever going to see anything that I can't unsee, you know? But luckily at this point, plus on the negative, you can kind of, that's almost a level of separation. Like a negative, you can't truly, really see something, but you can probably see it enough to determine probably not something you want to scan. So,
have you developed something and said that's not worth keeping?
If I can see an image, I keep it. The benefit of using digital to scan, there are times when I can't, from the negative, tell if I got an image because it's either really like dense or it's really thin, the resulting image. But I can manipulate it enough in the scanner to determine if there's an image there. And a lot of the images I get are really poor quality. They're really... mold grows on the film and that comes into the image. Those things like transform it. It almost turns it into something new. And so I love images that have been altered by time and nature and all that. It transforms it beyond the image itself and turns it into something more artistic, I feel. And those degradations in the image and in the film tell a greater story as well. Like what has this thing gone through for 30 years before it got to me? Where has it been stored? It's got these streaks of like mold that go on people's that lay over people's faces, and they look alien. And it's just I actually truly love some of the more degraded images are some of my more favorite images in the archive.
Last of all, have you had the experience of saying, "Wow, I have found a fellow photographer who knows how to compose a shot. I found somebody who has artistry, and I found their images, but I have no idea who they are."
The vast majority of the images in the archive is amateur photography. You know, what similar to today, professionals generally process their film because they're getting paid for it or something like that. So the vast majority of our images are just people taking photos of their everyday life. And while they may not be as artistically composed for the most part, they have their own nuance to them that is really fun. And that's kind of the exciting part about it. And oftentimes, like, it's when an image maybe isn't composed as well, it shows something that it shows more of the life that maybe a photographer, like, who is thinking about composition, wouldn't, right? Because a photographer is going to focus on the subject. They're going to frame it with, you know, proper amounts of like headspace and all that. But if a kid grabs a point and shoot and just accidentally pops off a shot that's like looking up his dad's nose, you get things that you wouldn't normally see. And that's the intimate part of getting to see in someone's personal life, is like you get that shot of the corner of the room where the weird wall art is hanging or what, like you get to, it's almost like they tell more stories. It's easier to get an idea of how people live. And so that's what I really like about it.
Yeah. I think you kind of like the uncontrolled aspect of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a certain amount of voyeurism to like seeing into people's lives. Like I think we all have it to an extent. Like we say, people are like, it's good people watching. Well, what is people watching? Well, it's kind of being voyeuristic and watching other people. There's an aspect of that to this project where you are getting to kind of peek and peer into people's personal lives, and go with them on vacation and go and spend Christmas morning with them and Halloween and go to funerals and see mourning, right? And there's an aspect to this, which is why the amateur component of it to me is truly special. And it also makes it puts normal people's lives on a pedestal, and it curates this, it's the curation of American life shown in a way that generally isn't curated that way, right? You curate images in art galleries that are shot by professionals with beautiful landscapes and Ansel Adams to show, you know, what America looked like, but what does America look like to most Americans? And I wouldn't want to say just America, we have images from all over the world, but what does that look like? That truly is one of the more special things that I've come to love about it. As it grows, it has taken on this thing that puts real life and how we all experience it kind of together.
It's a great project, a great story. I'm so glad I had a chance to visit with you. Levi, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Levi Bettweiser has been with us. He's a photographer and founder of the Rescued Film Project. Our next stories here on Constant Wonder, a little bit heartfelt, at least heart-focused. William Harvey was the Englishman who in the early 17th century proved how blood moves through the body because of the heart. Harvey was also a skeptic, by the way, about witchcraft, and he once dissected an alleged witch's supposedly magical toad to prove that there was nothing magical in that toad. We have come a long way in our medical knowledge since then. Less magic, more science. But we're still making breakthroughs at the heart of human anatomy. We're going to look at some of those recent breakthroughs and consider the lives that they've saved when we return to Constant Wonder. Stay tuned.